This is a Building Bridges, your community and labor report special. I'm Amy Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
We examine issues of law and social justice with V. Suresh of the People's Union for Civil Liberties in Madras, Chennai, and India. Suresh practices law as an advocate in the Madras High Court and also serves as the General Secretary of the People's Union for Civil Liberties, Tamil Nadu. That is a national-level human rights organization. And we welcome you.
Thank you.
Suresh, why don't we begin by just giving somewhat of a sense of where we are in terms of we're looking at a really post-tsunami, but we want to find out more about the organization that you're working with and what it portends for assistance in a more permanent way to the people who have been so hard hit in the states of Tamil Nadu and other areas of India.
I belong to a national-level human rights organization called the People's Union for Civil Liberties, and it's a non-funded voluntary body which exists in about 20 of the 30 states of India. In Tamil Nadu, which has been very, very badly damaged by the tsunami, what we are doing is to evolve a coordination committee of all groups and concerned citizens and professional bodies to monitor relief and policy relating to rehabilitation. In the wake of the tsunami disaster, huge amounts of aid and money is pouring into the country. We feel that much of this aid, which comes with a lot of good intention from a lot of people, will have to be channelized so that it fits in with the priorities of the people. And we also feel that over aid can be as damaging as no aid at all. It is for this reason that we floated this idea along with many NGOs, as also international donor agencies, impressing upon them the need for three things. One would be that all relief and rehabilitation effort would have to not only be culturally sensitive to people's needs, but also not result in making people dependent on aid. The second would be that all aid and rehabilitation should be oriented towards the identified cultural needs of people and help them in regaining livelihoods. So we feel that the people should be enabled to get back to their livelihood as fast as possible. And third, and this is the most important thing, which is that we feel that all aid efforts should be completely transparent and accountable so that both the affected persons as also others know the money which has come in to help them actually has been used to actually help them.
Suresh, how have you come together to affirm the dignity and uphold the self-respect of the affected fishing and other communities and to identify ways to support the efforts to rebuild the lives and livelihoods of the people there?
We have had meetings and discussions with many of the groups who have been working in the tsunami-affected areas. The PUCL by itself does not work in any of the relief areas. There are many other groups, including, for example, journalist bodies. There is the Indian Medical Association, which is the premier medical, the doctors group in the country. There are many other professional bodies who we have brought together under this banner with the understanding that it will be a very inclusive body and it would be something in which people's concerns would be reflected. So it's been a very collaborative, very inclusive, supportive type of a process in which there are no leaders, in which we try to ensure that everybody's voices are heard. And very importantly, we have also sought to bring in actual victims, fishing community leaders, affected leaders of various non-fishing communities, and so on.
You said too much aid can destroy the destroy the cultural fabric of the community. Could you elaborate on that more?
What happens is that in many such instances of mass disasters, especially if you study the type of relief that has poured into the earthquake in Gujarat or in Orissa in India, or in other places, much of the aid that comes in also comes in with strings attached. One would be that the aid would be channelized towards buyback of certain aid agencies from the various countries, or they would insist on certain type of aid projects which may not be culturally suited to the needs of the people. To give you an example, most of the affected communities this time have been fishing community, which lives on the shore. One has to be extremely sensitive to sanitation needs on the seashore. There have been experiences where major toilets have been constructed in the shallow regions very close to the coast, which have affected the groundwater. Habitations are now being proposed, for example, in Tamil Nadu, in which the fishing community, which is a very fiercely independent community, whose life is a life of daily survival, and which has been living on the shores for countless millennia, are now being asked to live in 8x10 shanties, about 3 kilometers away from the coast. Now, these are the type of cultural insensitivities which in the long run can not only shackle the fishing community, which has been badly ravaged in the tsunami, but can also end up in alienating them from their cultures and their histories. This is a matter of tremendous concern for us.
Is there also fear that some of the richer groups, some of the more powerful groups might hijack the aid to reinforce their own dominance and with regard to fishing trawlers or other land interests?
I think this is an ever-present danger, Ken, in the sense that hijacking, especially by the more dominant communities, is a reality in our part of the world. There are political interests at play who are sensing enormous amounts of money pouring in. There are other vested interests which are close to the ruling groups who also see the possibility of enriching themselves, all in the name of aid. This is something that has been concerning us, which is why we have said right from day one, which is about a day after the tsunami hit, that transparency and accountability has to be cardinal principles in all relief and rehabilitation. And this principle would cover the efforts of both the government as also international donors in particular.
Yeah, could you be more specific with regard to the fishing industry? Are we talking about the big trawlers there? What's the role of Australia in this? If you could be more specific.
There are 2-3 issues which have come up in the last couple of days which are extremely worrying. To give you more meat, as they would say, in terms of what we are talking about, there have been reports of aid coming in, for example, from Australia. The aid would be a tied aid in the sense that the aid would be towards purchase of trawlers from Australia. Now, we hear that many of the trawlers, the trawler industry in Australia has been suffering depression in the last 5 years, and many trawlers there are out of use. Now, in the name of aid, we fear that the trawlers from Australia or from some of the other countries in Europe might be dumped into the coast of Tamil Nadu, as also in many other parts which have been affected by tsunami. Now, the difficulty here is that the aid in terms of rehabilitation packages for livelihood should be linked to the political economy of the coast. It has to be live to what has been the history of the people in terms of economic sustenance in the seas in the last, say, 5 to 10 years in wherever they are affected and they are living. In Tamil Nadu, for example, the state that I come from, the fishing industry has been going through a downswing in the last 5 to 8 years with more number of people fishing than the amount of fish that is available in that area. As many of your listeners would know, that 90% of fish yield or marine yield exists in 10% of the sea coast. Now, a tremendous amount of overpopulation exists in this coast. So if you're going to have many of the international agencies are promising the moon, literally, if you take all the promises made by different agencies, all the fishing community people in Tamil Nadu will probably have a boat or will have a trawler soon. Now, the hard fact of life is that there is not enough fish to be caught in the marine coast in that area. So we are scared that in the name of aid, what will happen would be that junked equipment, junked trawlers, junked fishing gear would be sent to India, which would be completely inappropriate here. A related issue is that, for example, of nets. We have been talking to a large number of the fishing community people, and after talking to them, we have come to know that there are at least about 5 to 8 varieties of net which the fishing community uses, depending on the season of the year and the type of catch that they are hoping to catch. Now, much of this net is indigenous. I mean, it is suited for the needs of our coastal marine ecology. But we have offers now for nets, as we read in the papers and elsewhere, from all over Europe, much of which may not be actually used here or useful here. Now, this is the type of issues that concerns us greatly, because what is going to happen is that we're going to be saddled with equipment which is non-functional, which is inappropriate, and finally, it is going to be not only letting the fishing community into a major trap, a trap of hope which is bound by failure at the start itself.
It would also seem that what you're suggesting is that this will be a tremendously opportunistic period in which one can expect big fishing trawlers to advantage themselves and displace the fisher people of areas like Tamil Nadu. And I'm also worrying about the seizure or expropriation of the land, since it must be enormously difficult for people who have been left with nothing to document their claim to the land. So what's going to happen there? Are we to expect similar opportunistic moves?
In fact, the issue has already burst out in Tamil Nadu. For this, one would have to understand the long history of the fishing community, which to a very large extent has lived in areas very contiguous to the coast, perhaps about less than half a kilometer from the sea coast itself. Much of this area, especially in areas close to urban settlements, has now fallen into demand of the hotel industry or big housing projects. There has been an eye of the housing industry, as also the big beach resorts, the beach houses of the rich, who have wanted to corner the land of the fishing community. The tsunami has come in as a godsend to many of these interests. Because in the name of providing for the security of the people, the fishing community has already been pushed away from the coast into areas about 2 or 3 kilometers away from the coast in the inland area. And they have been told that they cannot come back into the areas where their habitations existed earlier. We fear that this is a ruse for a large land grab movement, something that they could never do when the fishing community was not decimated the way it is decimated today by forces of nature. We fear that what nature has caused to them is going to end up in a double tragedy for them. Not only have they lost their kith and kin, they're also going to lose their access to lands, which are their traditional lands.
Who determines who gets the aid? I mean, there are private relief organizations, there's the government of India. Who ultimately determines who gets the money for what?
We are, I think, going through a period of flux out here because there are large international NGOs who have come here who have been talking about bringing in huge amounts of money. There are multilateral bodies like World Bank and Asian Development Bank which have come in recently and have talked about large amounts of money. There is the Indian government itself which has pledged lots of money. There are corporate houses who have been talking about bringing in money. Now, it is in this situation that we fear that unless there is greater coordination and there are greater planning efforts made based on the needs of the people, much of this aid will ultimately end up in the lining the pockets of the rich and the mighty. An issue that has come to my notice, to our notice today, is, for example, the type of support which has been promised by the World Bank and the Asian Development Bank yesterday in Tamil Nadu. I would like to make use of this opportunity that you all have given to bring to the attention of your listeners that these multilateral institutions like the World Bank and Asian Development Bank have used the context of a massive tragedy, a human tragedy of unparalleled proportions, to come here and talk about, in very euphemistic terms, long-term rehabilitation packages. We have come to hear that this long-term rehabilitation package that they are offering is nothing else but loan. A loan which they offer to every other state government which takes money from the World Bank at the interest rate of 0.75%. So the support that has been promised by the World Bank and the Asian Development Bank is nothing else but a very nice, clever term for shackling the people, because ultimately much of this loan has to be paid back. They are not talking the language of grants. Grants would be something which is given to people in order to help alleviate and to enable them to get back to their feet. The support that has been pledged now by the World Bank and the Asian Development Bank is not in the language of aid. It is actually in the name of aid. What they are giving is loan. Now, these are the type of things which is the fine print in much of the aid that is being promised. We are going through a state of flux now because we don't really know what exactly are the terms of aid that is being given, which is why we are demanding that all these things be transparent, so people know exactly what is being offered and they decide what exactly they would like to take up.
Suresh, one of the, of course, hardest hit groups within those already who are suffering are the Dalits. What is the people's platform, the citizens' platform, that would look to the future livelihood of a group that is already pre-tsunami so terribly impoverished and beleaguered in India?
Yeah, the Dalit communities are what were formerly called untouchable community, a term which is politically not acceptable to the Dalit community today. But just to help your listeners understand the type of people we are talking about, which is people at really the bottom of the caste, economic and social hierarchy. Now, what has not been much publicized is that apart from the fishing community, which has been very, very badly affected, there are other communities which have existed on the sea coast, which have two types of occupational bases. One type of Dalit groups have been working in occupations which are subsidiary to the fishing community, which could include transporting of fishing, of fishes, cleaning of the marine catch, and other activities, including helping the marine industry. They would also involve a lot of other smaller trades. Much of this community has been also wiped out, along with the fishing community. Their livelihoods have suffered tremendously. There is another set of Dalit community in this area, which is not directly linked with the marine industry, but which have been working as indentured agricultural laborers on the agricultural fields very close to the sea coast. Much of this land, agricultural land, for example, in places in Nagapattinam, have become saline because of the intrusion of seawater into this area. They have lost all their livelihoods. The pity of the whole tragedy is that all the aid so far has been focused on helping the fishing community. The package that has been unveiled so far has not taken into account how it is going to address the needs and the difficulties of Dalit and other communities. I should also bring to the attention of your listeners, it is not just the Dalits alone. It is, for example, the minority communities, like the Muslims in some of these areas in Nagapattinam, and other lower caste communities, artisan communities, which have been equally badly affected. No rehabilitation plans have been evolved for these communities. This is a very, very major area. In the people's platform that we have formed, we have brought to the attention of the state authorities detailed lists of communities. We have listed out the names of the villages, the streets on which these communities are staying in, the number of houses which exist there, the number of houses which have been affected, the death toll in these of these communities, and giving more precise and specific information. The difficulties that these communities have experienced is twofold. One, they have not been identified as as victims of the tsunami. Now, this is a very critical issue, because unless you are identified as a tsunami victim and are given the necessary identification tokens, you're not entitled to any relief effort. Two, apart from the fact that they have been excluded from the relief, they have also been excluded from rehabilitation packages. There is nothing in the offing as at the moment as to a scheme identified by the government which would take into account the livelihood issues of these communities. They are completely out of the pale of rehabilitation, and this worries us tremendously, because this again is very much rooted to the social history of these communities.
The other thing that, just to switch gears just for a moment, one of the concerns that I had when I heard of the tsunami was, I know that there are two nuclear reactors that are on the coast of Tamil Nadu, and I was wondering how they were affected, or were they affected, and what impact this has had on those who have, shall we say, cried horse over the danger of nuclear reactors.
The potential danger that exists for nuclear reactors so close to the coast has been exposed by the tsunami. There is a nuclear reactor at a place called Kalpakkam, about 45 kilometers south of Chennai. The reports in the press indicated that water had come up to the second gate of the reactor, at which point in time the safety efforts were moved in and they closed the gates. The very fact that water had entered up to some point into the reactor is an issue which portends tremendous calamity in case safety efforts had moved in a little more slowly than it actually occurred. This has been an issue that we in the human rights movement and in the environment movement have been raising for several years now, which is that the Kalpakkam reactor is very close to a fault line, a geological fault line. In fact, the south part of the Indian continent actually exists on a major geological fault with the possibilities of an earthquake happening at any time. We should remind your listeners that exactly 3 years back, in September 2001, there was a mild tremor in this area, and there was an earthquake which had shaken many of the residential areas in Chennai and in the areas adjoining Chennai. It also had affected the city of Pondicherry, which is on the southern side of the Kalpakkam reactor. If, perchance, nature had decided to show its cruelty, and instead of a 6-point-something on the Richter scale, it had been an 8-point-something, I shudder to think what would have happened if the reactor had burst. It would have wiped out the entire city of Chennai, which has a population of more than 70 lakhs, which is about 7 to 8 million people, which is just about 40 kilometers or 45 kilometers away from Kalpakkam. There is yet another reactor at a place called Koodangulam in the southern region of Tamil Nadu, which is again very, very close to the seashore. This tsunami has now exposed the reality of the disaster that awaits people in this side of the world as to the perils of modern atomic power plants. However safe the scientists may talk about, the possibility of a major disaster happening, even if it is 10% on the globe or on the radar screen, is a horrendous possibility that has to be taken very seriously. Unfortunately, atomic issues in India is an area of national security, and it is an area which is protected under the Official Secrets Act. So the citizens of this country have absolutely no chance of knowing actual facts. We are not given any of the data relating to what happened even after the tsunami has occurred in a manner in which the common citizen can assuage themselves that these reactors do not pose a threat. Unfortunately, where people are not taken into confidence, there is a tremendous suspicion that all facts have not been shared with the people. This raises a larger issue of the role of the state vis-a-vis these atomic projects, especially in areas prone to environmental disaster. And this is another major Bhopal, I mean a much more horrendous Bhopal, in case anything terrible happens.
I was most interested in the rehabilitation plan, the citizens' platform for the tsunami-affected areas and individuals.
We are calling ourselves Kattumaram. Kattumaram Makkal Mede. Kattumaram in Tamil is a word for catamaran, which is widely known in to the English-speaking public. We chose this name also to identify with the fishing community. What we are hoping to do is to talk with the fishing community themselves, to enter into long-term plans with the fishing community. In this one issue that has shocked us, not just in Tamil Nadu, but it is also related to major tsunami-affected citizens elsewhere in the Indian Ocean region, is the fact that the fishing community has not been given time to emotionally come to terms with what has happened. As you would know, any bereavement takes its own time in terms of the people coming to terms with their own grief. In Tamil Nadu in particular, there's been tremendous controversy already about the fact that people have been pushed from pillar to post in terms of getting relief. We feel that the population has not had a chance to come to terms with the loss that they have suffered, to come to a terms with their own bereavement, and to come to a terms in terms of picking up the threads of their own life, which is why we have urged the government and we have also urged all the international aid agencies, multilateral agencies and other United Nations agencies, telling them, please give them these communities some time so that they can settle themselves before you talk about long-term rehabilitation plans. We are concerned that long-term rehabilitation plans are being hatched by bureaucrats and by development workers, specialists, without the involvement of the people. We don't think there is any major meaning in participation by giving them three choices which have been already evolved by these planning agencies or by the expert agencies. We feel that the community has to be involved right at the beginning because the community knows exactly what is required for them. I will give you an example because this is something which an elder in the fishing community told us. He said, see, I have to be in this, on the sea coast in the night. I look at the color of the sea tide. I look at the color of the wave and the sound of the wave. Mm. And I look at this and I know what is the type of fish that I can get and where in the ocean I can get. if you're going to push me 2 kilometers away from this area, how am I going to live? So what is now being offered in the name of rehabilitation packages are plants which we fear will have long-term consequences for the fishing community. In the platform, what we are urging the government and the agencies to do is to say, first give them time, and second, after you give them the time, let them come to grips with it, and then evolve a larger plan in terms of habitation, in terms of livelihood, in terms of rehabilitation vis-a-vis education, in terms of other occupational issues. I would also take this opportunity to bring to the attention of your listeners yet another issue of the fishing community, which we hear is common throughout the Indian Ocean region, which is that the marine economy cannot support large numbers of people. So the fishing community itself has been in a quandary, has been trying to find out alternative occupations for themselves. We feel that this tragedy presents a unique opportunity and that we should make use of the tragedy, which is very unfortunate, but we should use this unfortunate event as a means to bring about an improvement in the lives of the people by providing them occupational alternatives, by giving them employment alternatives, which would make them independent. We have to understand that the fishing community is a very, very, very independent community, which would react if there is any attempt which seems to be shackling them. We feel these are the concerns that would have to be taken into consideration
well, Suresh,
in terms of the rehabilitation.
We're going to have to leave it there. We thank you very much for joining us, and we've been speaking with V. Suresh of the People's Union for Civil Liberties in Madras, Chennai, India. And Suresh practices law as an advocate in the Madras High Court and also serves as the General Secretary of the People's Union for Civil Liberties. Thank you.
We
will be back to you in the weeks that come.
Yeah, thank you for this opportunity. Bye-bye.
And this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. And you can reach us at knash@igc.org. That's knash@igc.org.